Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Thanks for joining us here on The Conversation. This morning, Senator Brian Schatz talks about Trump 2.0, what his constituents are saying about living under President Trump's second term, and how our delegation plans to respond. Who's stepping up? The consumer advocate weighs in on a Hawaiian Electric report filed with the Public Utilities Commission about wildfire safety. And for this week's Manu Minute, we meet a bird that spends its winter vacations in the islands. Plus, we talk about internment camp history as the National Park Service marks the 10th anniversary of Honauliuli's designation as a National Historic Site. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Senator Brian Schatz has spent the last several weeks back here at home, going across the islands, talking to voters. He heads back to the nation's capital next week. Schatz stopped by yesterday afternoon to talk about what's on voters' minds.
I think people want to understand exactly how what's happening on the national level is going to impact their lives in Hawaii. So There's a bunch of us that watch national politics because we follow national politics, because we care about these federal issues and the sort of the state of the country. Most people are just trying to survive and want to understand what all of these changes are going to mean for their lives. And I think the most pressing issues coming up are the costs of Medicaid, the reductions in food assistance, and the possibility of the increase in energy costs. And so on the Medicaid piece, we have a little time before that bill is actually, or that law is implemented. But one of the things that we have to do is really reach out to every community member who is currently eligible for Medicaid and make sure they stay on the rolls, because these new eligibility requirements are actually designed to kick people off. And so, for instance, Waianae Comprehensive Community Health Center has 6,000 people who are on Medicaid, and they have eyeballs on each one of the 6,000 human beings. And so for them, they're going to be able to do case management one by one and make sure everybody understands that there are going to be new forms, there are going to be new requirements, and if you miss the thing by a day, you're off. There will be no flexibility if you get the flu, if your Wi-Fi craps out. Like, the whole purpose of these new eligibility requirements is to get fewer people Medicaid. And so we have to work against that. But I think we're in a good position to do that just because we have more social trust and more institutions that are capable of working together. And I think the same goes for SNAP, for food assistance. On the electricity side, the loss of those tax credits doesn't mean that we won't go forward with our solar and wind projects, because frankly, it's all we have, the alternative being to ship in fuel oil from Asia, usually at a higher price. But it does mean that some of these new power purchase agreements are just not going to be as cheap for the consumer over the next 2 to 3 years. Some things we can do something about, other things not in the short run.
We had on recently the head of the California Energy Commission, and he was saying in this climate, he says the good thing is a lot of states do have the authority, though, to decide on some things. And yeah, if people get kicked off solar for all, that's unfortunate. But we can still set policy to deal with climate change because it's a reality.
Yeah, that's right. We're going to have to go back to the original strategy that we had in the first Trump term, which was states and counties and public service commissions and public utilities commissions and legislatures across the country are still driving towards the clean energy future. And because of what we did with the Inflation Reduction Act, the market has already decided to bet on wind and solar and geothermal and nuclear power. And so will it be a little slower? Yes. Will it be more expensive for consumers? Yes. But the overall trajectory in the direction of a clean energy transformation will not change.
I just think of looking down on the landscape, and as an island state, there are so many ramifications, whether it's SNAP and Medicaid, and making sure that you comply with the employment requirements. Like on Molokai, there aren't 7,000 jobs readily available for everybody. So there are all these unique challenges as you go from island to island.
Yeah, you're exactly right. And that's why I want to make sure to articulate where I think I can make a difference. and where we're going to need everybody's help. But you're exactly right. Molokai, it may be very difficult for Medicaid-eligible individuals to demonstrate that they're employed because there's not a sufficient number of jobs. On Hawaii Island, there may be a sufficient number of jobs, but you still have the paperwork that is extremely onerous and challenges if this is all done online in terms of uploading this. So some of it's going to be a technological solution. Some of it's going to be a community-based, like, case management type solution. And we're just going to have to tailor our response. The one thing I think differentiates us from almost any other place is when there is a natural disaster or a man-made disaster or any massive change in our society, we're actually able to assemble key community leaders and come up with a plan together. That is not the kind of thing that you can do in other states just because it's not an island state. And so we have to really take advantage of what differentiates us as we navigate through this. We are going to get through this, but I'm not sugarcoating it. Usually I come home and I focus on all the federal funding that I got and all the rest of it. And we're still delivering more than 95% of the federal funds that we expected. But it's not a good news story. There are some really rough patches, especially as it relates to the University of Hawaii and climate action and some other areas.
I know for the research money that's on the chopping block, the administrators are trying to be real about what's going on, but they just know we might get through this year and this fiscal year. The outlook doesn't look good at all. And that's our economic engine, right? Kudos for their getting in all their extramural research funds. And they're trying not to cut warm bodies, but our economy is going to take a real hit.
Yeah. What's happening with the university and what's happening with transportation are similar in the sense that a lot of these funds have not been canceled. They have been frozen or paused for review. And so in both cases, it's a new administration and they may not have the same view about, say, environmental justice or sustainability or climate as the previous administration, and fair enough. And so the thing that our agencies are trying to do is to say, look, just because it has the word climate or justice or equity, or for that matter, women in it, does not mean that it is not like core scientific research. And we've been able to tangle some of those freezes. And for the most part, the money is being released. There are some areas where those cuts are acute and really harmful. As a macroeconomic matter, it's not as impactful as it is for the people doing the work. So I think if you ask UHERO or any of the people who do budget projections, it's a couple $100 million, which is a ton of money, but it's not enough to say our economy is suffering. It is more like the important work that the University of Hawaii was doing in certain areas is just going to be discontinued. But on the DOT side, I'm relatively confident that almost all of the projects that were approved under the bipartisan infrastructure bill are going to eventually get released. And I'm in a constant dialogue with Secretary Duffy saying, look, it's not woke to improve the Hilo Bayfront. There's nothing left or right about helping to stabilize the Wailuku Bridge outside of Hilo Town. And so we're untangling a lot of the money, but I don't think anyone can solve for full illegality, right? If they go ahead and cancel things and they're not permitted to cancel them, then the best that we can do is sue in federal court and get an injunction to release the dollars. That has happened in a couple of instances with EPA funds. But, you know, what my staff does is, look, there's enough to be frustrated about for your average citizen. They look at their phone, they look at their television, and they want to wail away about how awful it all is. I get to do that for a half a second, and then I got to get to work. My staff tracks a spreadsheet of all federal funding every day. And we have multiple categories, whether it's in, whether it's canceled, whether it's frozen, whether it's being litigated, whether we're in a negotiation with whatever, Region 9 or this or that. And we try to make sure that even as I do the fighting in the sort of partisan context, that I'm still taking care of my core responsibility, which is to make sure that Hawaii has the resources that it needs.
We've been hearing from Senator Brian Schatz, who dropped by our studios yesterday afternoon after meeting with voters across the state in the last couple of weeks. We will have more of his interview coming up after a short break. get back to our conversation with Senator Brian Schatz, who has spent the last couple of weeks traveling the islands to meet with constituents. We hear his thoughts about what the Democratic Party leaders can do to counter the actions of the Trump administration. Hawaii has long been a Democratic state, and there are some people who might be upset. I know when I go cover these protest rallies, No King's Day, that kind of thing, that we are hearing that people are scared and they're angry and they're looking to the Democratic Party saying our leaders need to hold some kuleana, some responsibility for where we're at right now and the assaults that our institutions are under, whether it's the Institute for Libraries and Museums to USAID. And so they may be looking to the party to say, okay, who's stepping up? How are we going to navigate through this?
Yeah, I think it is understandable to be frustrated with the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party had a nominee until the last moment who was, I think, in the eyes of the voters, just incapable of doing the job. And then you have this person who seems to have done multiple disqualifying things over the last decade, who won pretty decisively, didn't just win the Electoral College, but actually won the popular vote by a point or two. And so it should cause Democrats to do some self-reflection. I think that we became afraid of the future. We became interested in protecting the status quo. And when you think about all the gains that we've made as a party, if it's civil rights, if it's human rights, if it's abortion rights, that we had frankly made so many gains both in the cultural and the political context that we got a little comfortable with the idea of protecting those gains as opposed to leaning into the future. And whatever you thought about Donald Trump in this last election, whether it was the crypto stuff or the way his rallies were operated, it looked fun. It looked confident. It looked like they were not uptight. And it looked like they wanted to disrupt the status quo and lean into whatever the future would hold. And I think Democrats became the party of the status quo and protecting all the gains of the past. And so whoever our nominee is in the future and whatever the sort of next iteration of the Democratic Party is, we have to be a little more inclined towards risk and a little more optimistic. I think a couple of the areas where Democrats can thrive, but it would be a break from the past, is to be the party of building things.
And not breaking things.
Yeah. But also physically, I mean it. I don't mean that as a metaphor. I think we have to be the party that is into building things. If I came up through the environmental movement in Hawaii, which was and still is organized around stopping bad stuff, and that's a very appropriate role for the environmental movement. But if we're going to build a just society, and if we're going to solve this planetary crisis, we are going to need to build a ton of housing, and we're going to need to build a ton of clean energy. And all those laws that we built up over the last 50, 60 years to stop bad stuff from happening are now being weaponized against building the future that we all say we want. And I think it's okay for us to say, if you give us power again, we're not just going to reconstitute the sort of pre-Trump status quo. That, I think, will not inspire very many people. Of course, we want to restore women's reproductive choice. Of course, we want to be fair and just with our LGBTQ friends. Of course, we care about all the gains that were lost, but we also have to describe a government that works a little better than it did in the first place. So I think housing and energy are a place where we could be a little more, I don't know if the right word is hawkish, but a little more leaning forward into building stuff and not being so terrified about it all. And I also think that AI, while it's also a bit scary for what it means for the workforce, is an area where we can make a brand promise as a government and say, you shouldn't have to spend more than 5 minutes on the phone or online with your government before you figure out exactly what they need from you and what you need from them. And AI makes that a deliverable that we could really think seriously about, as opposed to thinking as AI as sort of exclusively a risk vector that must be regulated. I also do think it's a risk vector that needs to be regulated. But it is happening whether we like it or not, and we should marshal those forces in healthcare, in energy, in government services. And I'm hoping like 15 years from now, people will say, remember when you had to wait on the phone to get through to Kaiser Permanente? Like, it'll sound ridiculous. But I just think vibes-wise, people want to see a Democratic Party that's not terrified of losing what they've got and is thinking about building that next generation of accomplishments.
I think whether it's the elimination of mail-in voting or the whole thing of creating emergencies, whether it's at our border in our cities where crime is down, people do feel assaulted, I think. And I think there are folks who would like to see a healthy two-party system. And you see this pendulum swinging and the damage that's being done. It's sad.
Yeah. And it's a bit of a challenge, I think, for all of us, because you don't want to overreact or underreact. It is very clear that sometimes when Trump is nervous about either job numbers or what Wall Street is doing to respond to his tariff policies or the Epstein files, he actually does things specifically to distract the general public. And so I think it's worth pointing out that these are distractions, but sometimes those distractions are real actions that cause real harm. Like his idea of essentially controlling the content inside of the Smithsonian museums is, that's really dictator stuff. Like that's Cultural Revolution stuff, right? The fascist playbook is you win a democratic election and then you consolidate power by controlling the media, controlling cultural institutions. And he is trying to do that. The thing that gives me a bit of hope is that, yes, he's goofing around on all this, but he doesn't have the raw power to control the culture. And he can mess with CBS and they can buckle, and he can do authoritarian things, but he's a heck of a long way from being able to control free speech in the United States of America, because we have too many great institutions that would not roll over for him. The other thing I would say is that if you compare what he's doing to the leaders of, say, Belarus or Turkey, and he is following their playbook, the things that they did, all of those things, purging of intellectuals, anti-science behavior, trying to control media outlets, blah, blah, blah. He's doing all those things and becoming less popular. And those other leaders did all those things, consolidated power, and it was widely ratified by the general public. So there is something about being an American where a lot of people did vote for Donald Trump. Most people voted for Donald Trump, but they didn't vote for him honestly, thinking that there were going to be masked men removing people from a Home Depot or a church or a hospital or a school. When they thought about border security, they just wanted to get rid of the bad guys and didn't want it to be a mess on the border. But they had no idea that there were going to be people like designated to terrorize certain communities. And what gives me the most hope is that democracy is not a spectator sport. It's not what we have. It's what we do. And people are looking at this and saying, nope, that's not what I meant. And on top of everything, probably the things that made people the most furious about the Biden administration in order were inflation, a president that didn't look like he was on the ball, and disorder in the streets. And I think inflation is worse. This president does not look like he's on the ball, and he's not a kid. It was fair enough to criticize Biden for him maybe not looking like he had lost his fastball, but I also think that's true about this president. And it's a different kind of disorder on the street. It's precipitated by the federal government as opposed to being caused by a lack of the federal government intervention. But regardless, if you're that swing voter who thought you were getting some kind of orderly chief executive, you're now getting all of the same problems, probably 15% to 25% worse. And then you add to it the fascism and the corruption and all the rest of it. So I am, in the long run, very hopeful for American-style democracy. I just think the next couple of years are going to be very rough.
All right, Senator Schatz, we certainly appreciate you carving out time for us.
Thank you.
That was Senator Brian Schatz talking to us about what he's been hearing from voters, as well as the future of the Democratic Party. We did want to share with you some of the recent listener feedback we've gotten. Our first caller had a response to our interview with a state elections chief, Scott Nago, yesterday. The Maui resident also echoed something that we just heard from Senator Schatz.
Aloha. This is Nikhil Ananda calling from Hualu on the north shore of Maui. And I'm listening to Scott Nago speak with Catherine Cruz about going back to precinct voting, and I agree with Catherine. I used to love going to vote at the precinct, and of course now I vote by mail. It is a distraction. Our current president, he brings it up after talking to Putin. It's a distraction from all the crimes he's committing on our country. So now every news program, TV, radio is talking about that he wants to get rid of mail-in voting. It's not going to happen. It's a distraction. Thank you very much. Have a wonderful day. I love the conversation. And aloha.
We also received a call inspired by one of our segments last week about efforts to keep air conditioning systems running in schools. Carla on the Big Island has one idea to pass along for helping us all keep cool during the hotter months.
Hi, my name is Carla. I'm calling from the Big Island. I'm an artist, but I'm also old, really old. And I'd like to pass something on that I've been told I should pass on to the listeners. I've been in very hot climates a lot of my life, and I've had been in cars that didn't have air conditioning and had very bad responses. And one day, I just, out of the clear blue, I grabbed a kind of a large washcloth and soaked it in water and put it on the back of my neck. And that was about 3 years ago, and I have never, any time I'm hot or I'm working outside my yard or I get in the car and it's boiling hot, I put that washcloth, any washcloth with water, it doesn't even have to be cold water, and it immediately brings your body temperature down. And I would like you very much to share this with listeners because it could save people's lives. It's so weird, and it's so great. It's just so easy. And I think it's something a lot of people would benefit from. So I'm passing it on to you. And hopefully you'll pass it on to others. And thank you.
And thanks for that tip, Carla. I know I sleep with a giant ice pack in a pillowcase. Any other tips for beating the heat? Or maybe you have thoughts on our interview with Senator Schatz today. Give us a call, 808-792-8217. The state consumer advocate has been poring through a wildlife safety report filed by Hawaiian Electric Company and has flagged some deficiencies. Here with the story is HPR's Savannah Harriman-Pote. Hi, Savannah.
Hi, Catherine.
So what kind of shortcomings are we talking about?
Yeah, just to give listeners a little bit of understanding on the process, because we're going to throw out a lot of entities. Hawaiian Electric has been working on wildfire mitigation efforts for many years, but after the Maui fires in 2023, the Public Utilities Commission mandated that they make an official mitigation plan and give it to the PUC for them to review and approve. And that process is underway now. The Consumer Advocate, the Division of Consumer Advocacy, in processes before the Public Utilities Commission, represents the interests of the public. And so they actually brought on experts who have experience in looking at wildfire mitigation plans. Their name is Jensen Hughes, this consulting firm, to evaluate what HECO submitted. And Jensen Hughes filed this big report that identified several concerns. So Michelangelo, he heads the Division of Consumer Advocacy, and he called HECO's current strategy a work in progress.
The utility is actively working to continuously improve its wildfire safety strategy, and that it is going to be an ongoing effort. We certainly didn't expect right out of the gate that it was going to be best in class. We know that it's going to be continuing to move in that direction, and our expectation is that they'll continue to work toward that. It is still significantly reducing wildfire risk. It just needs to keep going in that direction.
Okay, so it needs tweaking. But what are some other specific concerns about the plan?
So the concerns are big. Jensen Hughes found that while HECO's plan technically met the minimum requirements set out by the Public Utilities Commission, key elements were underdeveloped and or below industry standards. So they broke down the plan into 11 components, and they gave each a report card, essentially. Two components, HECO's wildfire risk maps and its modeling of wildfire hazards, were determined to be in need of critical and immediate improvement. And then every other element was considered sufficient, but still needing improvement in some areas. So all of these are rated out of 4 being best. HECO was mostly getting 1s and 2s on its elements.
So what are the elements that are thin?
So let's begin with the wildfire risk maps. Those were created using available data about past fires in Hawaii that have ignited and how large they are, as well as different types of vegetation and where they grow, as well as existing state maps on what communities are at risk of wildfire. HECO has taken all of those data sources and put them to create its own risk maps that determine where it's going to invest resources, what communities might be at risk, things like that. Jensen Hughes says that the data sources on historical fires and at-risk communities that HECO is using are insufficient, and they're just not on par with industry standards. And one of the main challenges is that those data sources don't actually reflect fires that have been caused by or are related to utility infrastructure, rather than just fires in general. They want to see a map that is really representative of how HECO's infrastructure has ignited or started faults that start fires. But the problem is the utility hasn't historically collected that data, so they need to create this new data source in order to be on par with industry standards. And then the issue with those risk maps plays into the deficiencies with their risk modeling, right? Because that is basically they look at the maps and then they're able to model from that where the wildfire hazards are. And the report from Jensen Hughes says that, quote, given the major technical flaws with the current wildfire risk maps, it's unclear if the risk model appropriately identifies high-risk utility infrastructure.
Yeah, it's so interesting. And, you know, this report, I'm sure, is on a lot of people's minds just because, you know, overnight we had two evacuations, one here on Oahu up at Kunia and the other one on Molokai. So, you know, it's so dry out there and the winds were whipping. So it's a bit unsettling.
And that brings up another important thing that the consultants said need work, and that's situational awareness. So when there is a fire, or hopefully before there is a fire, what information does the utility have about real-time conditions, and how can it coordinate with different emergency response managers? And HECO is investing a lot in this. I actually spoke with HECO and their partner Alert West just last week about this new network of cameras that are equipped with artificial intelligence to help detect wildfire outbreaks in remote locations. Scott Schifando is with Alert West, and he says so far HECO has put up 180 cameras deployed across 139 locations.
So what we've done is we've taught the artificial intelligence what fire and smoke looks like based on historical fires. And so now it has a pretty good idea of exactly what is smoke and what is not smoke, but at the same time, it's not perfect. And so what we do is we implement a 24/7 operations center based out of Chico, California, that supports all of the different agencies actually across 11 states. And so the system detects the potential smoke. A human confirms whether it is actually smoke. If necessary, they'll move a camera onto the potential smoke and either confirm or deny it is smoke. And then after that point, they will go ahead and generate an alert.
Yeah, that's so interesting, using AI. I mean, I know in my neighborhood, they were testing some new curing system in the water pipes, and it was emitting white smoke, and a lot of people got nervous and they kept calling the fire department. So you just never know what's out there. And yeah, you need to verify, is this a real fire or not?
Yeah, and so that is one thing that they've installed. They're also installing more weather stations to get their own data about how dry conditions are, rainfall patterns, things like that. And Jensen Hughes, they acknowledged all of this work in their analysis, but they raised concerns that mainly focused, again, in areas that the utility, based on its maps and modeling, has deemed to be high risk. And that data, once again, was determined to be insufficient. And climate change could cause hazardous conditions in areas where we have not historically thought of fires being a problem. So I also want to note, right, in terms of things that could be front of mind for consumers, another area where the report said that the utility was falling short was with its power safety, public safety power shutoff programs, a tough acronym, the PSPS program. And listeners may be familiar with this. This is new protocols under which the utility might preemptively cut the power in certain areas when hazardous wildfire conditions occur. And HECO essentially, or Jensen Hughes essentially said that HECO has not evaluated the burden that those power outages could place on customers, specifically those who rely on electricity to power medical devices. So TIFO is advising people who are medically vulnerable, who live in areas where the utility might shut off the power if they feel a wildfire may occur, to leave that area. But the experts noted folks who have disabilities may not be able to independently leave. Other utilities on the continent have tried to address this by providing customers with portable batteries or perhaps transportation to care facilities. HECO has yet to institute those types of programs, and so they're saying that that work is not up to snuff.
Well, it's interesting because I know just this summer I did notice more intense messaging about that. People who are medically fragile on equipment that requires power, they were warned to have backup.
Yes. And so HECO said in response to the consumer advocate, they say, we're working in all of these areas. We appreciate the Division of Consumers Advocacy's input into the process. And we do see rooms for growth. But right now, we think that we have met the minimum requirements set forward by the Public Utilities Commission. It will be up to the Public Utilities Commission whether or not they want to approve, accept with conditions, or reject the plan. The consumer advocate is saying, move forward the process, but please ask the utility to put forward a timeline as to when it is going to address these concerns. So we're waiting to hear back from the PUC. I also want to note, Kauai Island Utility Cooperative is part of the same process, and the consumer advocate is reviewing their plan as well.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you so much, Savannah.
Thank you, Catherine.
That was HPR's Savannah Harriman-Pote with a story about Hawaiian Electric's wildfire safety report. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. Summer's almost over, and the change of seasons means migration. The Kia Ao started its journey south in August. These long-billed shorebirds are not common on the main Hawaiian islands, and so we have their call for you from the Makaule Library at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. Here's University of Hawaii at Hilo Professor Patrick Hart with your Manu Minute.
The Kioea, or bristle-thighed curlew, is a medium-sized shorebird with a wingspan of almost 36 inches, a long, downwardly curved bill, and long grayish legs. They're mostly mottled brown and get their English name from the very noticeable bristle-like feathers at the base of their thighs. With a total population size of about 7,000 birds, Kioea breed in the summer in Alaska and make the long, non-stop flight back to Hawaii and other islands in the South Pacific every August to escape the Alaska winter. Adults generally fly back to Alaska to breed in early May. But once the juveniles arrive for their first winter in Hawaii, they stay for 2 or 3 years because they don't breed until they get older. This makes it possible to see them year-round in Hawaii, primarily in typical shorebird habitats like wetlands, shorelines, and grassy areas. If you see a bird near the shore with a really long, downward-curved bill with a call that's been described as sounding like whistles of an adoring pursuer, you're probably looking at a kioea. The word kioea means to stand high, as on long legs, and they were important in early Hawaii as they were one of the few birds mentioned in the Kumulipo, or Hawaiian creation chant. Kioea are the only known shorebird to actively use tools for foraging. They've been observed grabbing pieces of coral in their bills and rearing their head back in a big arc to forcefully toss the coral at seabird eggs to break the shell so they can feed on the contents. While kioea love eggs, they also feed on crustaceans, small fish, and insects. Kioea are the only shorebird that can't fly for a period of time when they're molting new feathers in Hawaii, making them susceptible to predators. This is likely one reason why they are much more common in the predator-free northwestern Hawaiian islands, like Midway and Laysan. For Hawaii Public Radio, this is Patrick Hart from the UH Hilo Department of Biology.
Support for HBR comes from the Honolulu Board of Water Supply, Ohana, working to protect and manage Oahu's water resources since 1929 for fresh water now and for future generations. BoardofWaterSupply.com.
This weekend's classical music performance with Megan Conley for Live from the Atherton series is sold out. We are adding another show, same day at 2 p.m., so you have a chance to come. Don't miss this opportunity. For tickets and more information, visit hprtickets.org. Sponsored by HMSA.
Hawaii Public Radio is here for you and with you through the magic of discovery.
Brian Eno with a song called The Big Ship. I'm Jeff Long. You are listening to Bridging the Gap. My friend Taylor turned me on to that song, and I remember running on those hot Waianae mornings listening to this song and just feeling like I could just handle anything.
Local music shows on HPR are always brought to you with a personal touch.
So I figured this is too good to pass up, so I'm sharing it with you today on Brazilian Experience on HPR 1, and I'm your host, Sandy Tsukiyama.
Support music discovery on Hawaii Public Radio. Donate at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor The Hidden Nene.
You know, 10 years ago, the Honouliuli internment camp was officially declared a National Historic Site. The National Park Service is commemorating the occasion with an event tonight. Alan Rosenfeld, the Associate Vice President for Academic Programs and Policy for the University of Hawaii System, will be giving a talk entitled Breaking Down Myths and Assumptions About Wartime Internment in Hawaii. Rosenfeld was part of a research team whose work was instrumental in getting the historic site established. As Rosenfeld's work as a historian of post-war Germany demonstrates, the internment camp populations were much more expansive than the large Japanese populations that are often remembered. He talked to The Conversation's D.W. Gibson about some of the factors we sometimes overlook when talking about internment in Hawaii and how this history might inform our current political environment.
I'm the person who has focused the most on German and Italian internees, or better put, those who were classified as German and Italian internees. Whether they were or not is a totally different matter. They certainly were internees, but they weren't always German or Italian. There was a very broad but intentional interpretation of who could be classified as an alien enemy.
I imagine that might fold into one of the myths. Your talk is built around the idea of these myths that we hold around internment camps. What are some of those most prevalent myths?
Absolutely. So one of the major quote-unquote myths is that only Japanese and Japanese Americans were interned in Hawaii. They were by far the largest group of internees. But first of all, we can poke that apart a little bit. One of my colleagues in this research group that I mentioned, Joyce Chinen, who does Okinawan history, she did analysis of the names and found that somewhere between 12 or 15% of all the Japanese interned in Hawaii were actually Okinawans. And there were many Koreans as well, because, of course, both Okinawa and Korea were colonized, occupied by Japan, were part of the Japanese empires. But they didn't always identify, they certainly did not, after more times, identify themselves as Japanese, especially in the context of what was going on in World War II. And then in addition to that, I have those classified as German and Italian Americans that I was focused on. And it was very useful from a pedagogical perspective, teaching a course as I did in Hawaii during World War II at UH West Oahu and engaging with different audiences to bring more people into the conversation. So if we're just talking about Japanese Americans, other people might feel, this doesn't concern me, I'm not ethnic Japanese. But when you say, you know what, it's much broader than you think. And had you been living here in 1941, 1942, you might also have been interned, even though you're not Japanese, even though you're a U.S. citizen, even though you were a U.S. veteran, even though you were a U.S. combat veteran. That changes the dialogue a bit.
And I'm guessing those are real life examples you're giving.
Real life examples. Absolutely. One case that I wrote about, Mario Valdastri was a naturalized American who was born in Italy, came over to the United States when he was younger, and wound up fighting in combat in the United States Army in World War I in Europe. Comes back to Hawaii. He became a successful contractor. He was renowned as a plasterer. He did work on Honolulu Hale. And at the time of the war, he owned although he had a contracting business, he owned a property, 9 acres of property in Kailua. The family suspects that one of their neighbors served as an informant and gave his name to the FBI agents because they had an eye on the property. Whatever the case may be, he wound up being picked up and interned. And among other things, it's interesting because I found in his files that he actually wrote a letter to President Roosevelt. Now, I don't know if President Roosevelt ever saw the letter. This is a guy in his 50s, and he said, "I'm a loyal American. I fought for this country in World War I. I will do anything to prove it. You release me from internment, and you can send me to the front lines in the most dangerous location, and I will fight for this country today." Sadly, tragically, his daughter got married while he was interned, and before he was released, she died in a car accident. He filed a petition for a one-day pass to attend his daughter's funeral, and it was denied. So when I started digging deep, it really pulled at me, at my emotions, right? As a human being, like, how could you not sympathize with someone in that position?
Yeah, that's tremendous there. And I was curious about even just the nature of the research you're doing. Tell us a little bit more about it and where you're doing it and how you go about doing this work in terms of finding out about the composition of the internment camps during the war.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. So there's a lot that was available in Hawaii. I was a volunteer once a week at the Japanese Cultural Center in their archives, and I helped organize their collection. And they had a lot of materials that were very useful, some that they had gotten from the National Archives themselves and others, donations, series of donations from the families of different internees from decades past. Also, at University of Hawaii, there's Hawaii War Records Depository, an archive they house at the library, the Hamilton Library over there. But there also was this gold mine trove of files that I encountered at the National Archive and Records Administration. I came across individual case files of the internees with mugshots, fingerprints, all the records on them. But also I came across the transcripts from the hearing boards. Now, they were picked up. For example, there were 108 arrested within 24 to 48 hours after the attack in Pearl Harbor in Hawaii, just German and as Germans and Italians. Most of them were U.S. citizens, not even including all the Japanese internees in the first day or two of the war. There were 108 just Germans and Italians. So all these folks were arrested. If they were on Oahu, they were taken to the immigration station on Alamoana Boulevard. The building is still there. And then they were quarantined or taken to Sand Island in temporary internment camp, which used to be a quarantine station. So if it was on Oahu, the hearings took place in the immigration building on Alamoana Boulevard, and they were ferried back over. So they might have been interned for 2 or 3 weeks, and they come to the hearing boards. And I could actually get the records of the actual hearings, including the record of Mario Valdastri, whose case I just referred to, and see exactly what the questions were and how he answered them. One incredible activity that I did with my students, I had copies of the hearing board transcript, and I had the students play the different roles, and we performed it. And it took about 12 minutes. I had, pointed to my watch. I said, we started at this time. We just ended at this time. They had hearing boards on the U.S. mainland as well. They had three. They're supposed to be civilian hearing boards. So they had three civilian judges, whatever you want to call them. In Hawaii only, they had one, but oftentimes two military officers who were also part of the hearing board. And what I learned from reading the transcripts, one thing that I learned was that it was the military officer, one of them, who almost always served as the executive and recorder. And that meant he, because they were all men, he was the one calling forth and summoning the witnesses and the defendants and posing the vast majority of questions. The defendants, they were technically allowed to have a lawyer. Almost none of them did. I didn't come across a single German or Italian internee who had a lawyer. If they wanted a lawyer, that would have been viewed suspiciously, and they would have been shipped back to the detention center for another couple of months, probably, until they got called forth again. There were no rights of appeal. The internees were actually removed from the courtroom, from the hearing room, for any witness testimony, their own witnesses or the government witnesses. So no disclosure at all. They were not even allowed to know who the witnesses were against them, let alone what they were saying about them. And then when the entire thing was over, the hearing board made a decision, but it went back to the FBI, the ONI, the Office of Naval Intelligence, and the Military Intelligence Division, the MID of the U.S. Army. Those were the three units that created the lists prior to the attack on Pearl Harbor that determined who was going to get arrested in the event of a war or an attack on Hawaii. So it's like you get declared innocent in a jury trial, and then it goes back to the arresting officer who can then overrule the jury and say, no, actually, you're guilty. So it's not exactly due process as we know it. And of course, Hawaii was under martial law, so that created a total different situation. I have an example from the hearing board transcripts of what I encountered. This is a family. There was a husband, wife, two sons, two teenage sons. Older son, I think, was 19. So they were actually Jewish refugees from Austria. They fled Austria after the Anschluss. Father lost his job as a bank clerk in Vienna. They lost their home. They lost their citizenship. They lost everything they had. They escaped through France, Norway, Belgium, New York City, and then Hawaii. The parents and the older son were all picked up and interned. During the hearing with the father, they asked him, okay, how do you feel about Adolf Hitler? And he said, how am I supposed to feel? I mean, he took everything from me. He ruined my life. And he said, quote, to me, it was the worst thing in the world. I will do anything I am able to do, end quote, for America to win the war. And you would think, of course, why would we doubt that? And then they asked him this question. If you had to choose between Satan and Hitler, whom would you choose? And it's crazy because you read in the answer, in the response, in the transcript, the first thing he says is, between what? You know, it's incredulity. What kind of question is that? And he said, I don't know. I think Hitler is worse in some respects. So thankfully, they did release him. On the flip side of this all is that this all happened right after the attack on Pearl Harbor, when there were Japanese submarines still shelling the ports on Kauai and Maui, and when there was an actual fear of a land invasion. For the first 2 or 3 weeks after the attack on Pearl Harbor, they thought the Japanese might launch an actual land invasion on Kauai. So there was a great desire for security, right? So, I mean, that is certainly part of the picture, and it can't go away. And the question, though, is that how do we navigate this tension between a desire for security on the one hand and the government's role in providing that security, and then the preservation of our civil liberties on the other hand?
Yeah, those foggy first days and weeks after a major disaster, it's hard to really transport yourself into the feeling of precarity and insecurity that dominates. Is there useful information, maybe even lessons, for contemporary America when studying World War II internment camps? Practical legal considerations, moral hazards that you see?
Absolutely. This is a topic that's in the front of the mind again today, right? The current political machinations. But one thing I would say is that people can make a difference, that the lives of the internees, even while they were interned, were dramatically improved by the efforts and assistance of a lot of local populations, local groups that rallied around them. For example, on Kauai, the local library donated books and board games. The Friends Society of the Quakers, they did a whole bunch of welfare assistance for like family members. The Quakers are one of the first society groups to rally around and try to provide them with some kind of welfare support. So that's one thing, right? So that you can make a difference in that regard. Another important point that I really try to stress, as a general rule, the people in DC were far stronger advocates for mass internment than the people here on the islands. And I'm talking about the authorities here on the islands. So one great example I can give of this is Secretary of the Navy, Frank Knox. So I believe it's partially apocryphal that he wanted to intern everyone on Molokai. So you have General Delos Emmons, who took over, I think, just before New Year's, 1941, I believe, as the military governor, right? Martial law, Delos Emmons is in charge at this time. And he knows that's a terrible idea. And he would come back with every excuse in the book. Now, I'm pretty sure this is an exaggeration, but in one correspondence I found, he wrote, 90% of the licensed carpenters in Hawaii are ethnic Japanese. So if we turn them all, who's going to build the camps, right? Or they would say, well, ship them to the mainland. And he would say, I have to prioritize shipping my troops and shipping my supplies. You want me to round up 150,000 civilians and use all our cargo space for that? So he was dragging his heels, trying to stall, not giving what they wanted. I mean, individuals can make a difference, and it's not this us against them, and the government is this one single monolith, but it's really a lot of competing forces and voices that don't agree. But in the end, a decision is made that impacts people's lives. But who knows? If it wasn't Delos Emmons dragging his heels, maybe there would have been a much more large-scale internment in Hawaii. And maybe that would have undermined our war effort in the Pacific.
We really appreciate you taking a look at it and spending some time with us talking about it today. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, DW. I appreciate the opportunity.
You know, that was Alan Rosenfeld talking to HPR's D.W. Gibson about internment in Hawaii during World War II. Just fascinating. He'll be giving a virtual talk over Zoom on this subject tonight at 7 p.m., sponsored by the National Park Service. For a link to sign up to the event, check out our website. Does it for us today, but tomorrow we plan to talk to Governor Josh Green about our economic drivers, tourism, and the military. Got anything you'd like to ask the governor about, or a story maybe you'd like to share? We do want to hear from you. Leave your feedback on our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Find our archive shows online by searching for The Conversation on Spotify, Apple, or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.